Cat Minds, Iran's president, says Tehran's decision to enrich uranium at 60% purity is a response to nuclear terrorism against the country. Palestinians slam as a racist crime new Israeli restrictions at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. And also in our headlines, U.S. police use pepper spray and flash bombs to disperse a fresh protest in the state of Minnesota over the latest police killing of a black man. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iran's president says that Tehran has responded to what he called nuclear terrorism at Natanz nuclear facility by installing more modern centrifuges and enriching uranium to higher purity levels.
They wanted to disrupt the operations of IR-1 centrifuges, but Iran's first response was to replace those centrifuges with IR-6 ones so that they will understand they cannot deprive Iran of peaceful nuclear technology through wicked acts. As a second response, Iran will also increase uranium enrichment from 3.67% purity level to 60%.
Rouhani said Tehran replaced IR-1 centrifuges with IR-6 ones as the first response to the Israeli regime's move against Iran. The president added Iran will not allow others to disrupt its peaceful nuclear program and will counter any plots in that regard. He reiterated that Iran will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal once the U.S. respects UN Security Council Resolution 2231 and removes all sanctions and Iran verifies their removal. The president underlined that Iran's activities have always been and will remain peaceful and under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Iran has officially informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its plan to start enriching uranium to a 60% purity level as of Wednesday, following Sunday's act of sabotage against the country's Natanz nuclear facility that Tehran blamed on Israel.
Yesterday we sent a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. Also today, we just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
Araghchi said the terror act against the Natanz site will help boost Iran's enrichment capacities. He also touched upon Iran's demands that it would put forward during the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA in Vienna.
We insist on what we have asked, that all sanctions should be lifted, we verify, and then we go back to full compliance if we are satisfied with the verification process.
President Hassan Rouhani also said all parties to the 2015 pact must honor the commitments they made while inking the accord. The Vienna talks that will be held this week have been eclipsed by the sabotage incident at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran's foreign minister blamed Israel for the incident, saying the move amounts to a war crime and nuclear terrorism. Mohammad Javad Zarif also denounced what he called Israel's terrorist idiocy, saying the regime has made a very bad gamble by sabotaging the Natanz facility that would strengthen Iran's hand in talks to salvage the JCPOA. He also warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in JCPOA talks.
Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Israeli media have acknowledged that Israel was behind the incident at the Iranian nuclear facility, but the U.S., Israel's closest ally, has denied any involvement. Nonetheless, on the same day that the Natanz site was targeted, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed again to do everything in his power to stop a verse for salvaging the JCPOA. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but for now, the sabotage act at the Natanz facility has further deepened Tehran's distrust towards Washington.
Fuad Izadia, professor of world studies at University of Tehran, says those behind the act of sabotage at Natanz nuclear facility have to pay the price for what they did.
Israelis need to pay a price. One price they would pay would be to actually have a nuclear program that's more advanced have enrichment level that is higher and have more enriched material. So basically doing what Israelis claim to be concerned about. The other track that I think the Iranian government is following is with the negotiations in Vienna, basically pointing out to the fact that Israelis are violating international law. You cannot just go and attack another country based on the bogus claims. Iranian leaders, I don't think they see any distinction between Israelis, Europeans, and Americans. I think the general idea here is that this is a division of labor. Israelis engage in terrorism and espionage. Europeans play host to diplomatic negotiations. And Americans play dumb. It's not really complicated to go back to JCPOA, but they want to make things complicated and cause difficulties and have a prolonged negotiation.
U.S. intelligence analysis has concluded that Iran is not undertaking activities toward developing a nuclear weapon. The study represents the conclusions of all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies. According to the report, analysts see few indications Iran will seek to change course. Iran has always maintained that its nuclear program is peaceful and merely for civilian purposes. Tehran also says it has never sought to make weapons of mass destruction, including nukes. Iran is a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and its nuclear work has been under the IAEA's intense scrutiny. The Islamic Republic says it is committed to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. Iran's leader has also issued a religious decree that bans building nuclear arms. Professor of Political Science Timothy Kurzweil says U.S. admission that Iran is not seeking to build nuclear weapons is definitely an advantage for the Islamic Republic.
Well, I guess even the U.S. intelligence agencies have to tell the truth sometimes, and this is one example of it, where they're saying what everybody else knows, is that the Iranian nuclear program is mostly directed towards domestic purposes of energy production and medicinal purposes, and there's no attempt to build a nuclear weapon. It's definitely an advantage to Iran now that there's been an admission that, it's a qualified admission, I suppose, they're saying at the moment, but still it's an admission that the program is at least being peacefully operated. And I guess that forces the U.S. to sort of negotiate in a way on different grounds than the way they were talking a couple of months ago. This combined intelligence report is happening at the exact moment this negotiation is taking place in Austria. And it's sort of, like I said, it's a give and take game where, mm-hmm. They're admitting the truth in one area, but then still using, amping up the idea of Iran as a threat as a way of trying to maintain their position at the negotiating table.
The news review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition of the program, Iran has summoned the ambassador of Portugal, the current holder of the European Union's rotating presidency, to protest the bloc's latest batch of anti-Tehran sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry slammed the sanctions as politically motivated. It noted that Tehran is considering counter-sanctions against the bloc. Iran has already said it will suspend comprehensive negotiations with the EU, which includes talks on human rights, and all cooperation based on the talks. This includes cooperation regarding refugees and fighting terrorism and drug trafficking. On Monday, the EU added 8 Iranian officials and 3 entities to its sanctions blacklist over alleged violation of human rights. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusation and criticized Europe for its double standard on the issue of human rights. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Mr. Tim Anderson, who's joining us from Sydney. Also, author and commentator John Stepling joins us now from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Anderson. Sir, give us your thoughts on these recent sanctions by the European Union, the timing of it, and also what is to gain from such actions.
Sanctions, so-called, or coercive measures that the EU has announced are not really of much substance, but they are an expression of bad faith. And at a time when the Europeans are pretending to play a more independent role in terms of resuscitating the virtually dead JCPOA, it's really a sign of bad faith which undermines the credibility of their position to to really come into these negotiations and say that they're representing something other than an echo of the US position here. So it's I don't really know. The Russian foreign minister said it showed a lack of coordination on the part of the Europeans, because on the one hand they've been arguing more sympathetically to try and resolve the difference they had with the Trump administration, but now they've dropped this in, and it's really undermined their credibility in those talks.
Mr. Stepling, what are your thoughts on these sanctions? Is there any significance to the timing, in your opinion?
Well, firstly, the hypocrisy is just jaw-dropping. The EU is pointing a finger at Iran and justifying the sanctions because of human rights violations. The list of violations from the U.S. and EU in terms of human rights is extraordinarily long. And it's interesting that Anthony Blinken, who was the deputy secretary of state under Obama in 2015, was one of the leaders in coordinating the U.S. Involvement in the Saudi assault against Yemen. And he was one of the cheerleaders. So it was Biden. And it facilitated a massive arms sales, of course, to the Saudis. And it resulted in one of the worst human catastrophes of hunger, cholera outbreak. I mean, it's been a complete disaster. And Blinken's fingerprints are on this. And at the time, the EU was also home to U.S. CIA black sites, one significant one in Poland. So nobody is mentioning the French state's reaction to the Yellow Vest protests, which was extremely violent, because the EU made a statement attacking Iran for overreaction against the Iranian protests in 2019. You could probably pick any country you wanted in the EU and find similar violations, allegedly, and yet nobody says anything. So for the U.S. and EU, which of course is just an echo chamber for the U.S. at this point, for them to point fingers at Iran in terms of human rights violations is just astounding. I mean, the hypocrisy is just beyond the pale. I don't know. I don't have any words for it. The U.S. and U.K. are complicit in the Yemeni disaster, the Saudi assault on Yemen. Nobody is pointing fingers at the Saudis for human rights violations. No, they are only pointing them at Iran. So, your other guest said bad faith. It is at the very least bad faith. It's surprising as well, because I didn't expect this to happen, and thought that the EU would use this opportunity for some kind of step towards rapprochement or something with Iran, but apparently not. And the Biden administration is giving a clear signal to what their foreign policy is going to be in the region, I think.
Tim Anderson, also your thoughts on what Mr. Stepling just mentioned, the issue of the hypocrisy that we're seeing from the Europeans. There's the issue of the migrant crisis right now, the harsh police crackdown that we've seen in France and in the United Kingdom. How do you explain the double standards that we're seeing now?
Well, double standards are central to imperialism. That's the first thing. I think it's even more than hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is a little bit simple in a sense, because all of the human rights claims of the last 20 years in relation to West Asian countries are effectively a smokescreen to draw attention away from the massive abuses involved in the seven wars that have been carried out and are still being carried out, including the economic war and the propaganda war. So this smokescreen constantly throwing up pretexts for some sort, in this case, some inflated figures from Amnesty International in London, which is now very deeply linked to the British and the US regimes, basically throwing up some of those things for this pretext. It's saying, look over here, don't look at the fact that we have slaughtered on the most conservative estimate, more than 2 million people in West Asia in the last 20 years, or on the other estimates, up to 5 or 6 million people. This is the scale of the war, the full spectrum war involving economic war, which is now starving people in Yemen and Syria and across the region. And so I think it goes beyond hypocrisy, really. We should see it for what it is, a smokescreen to draw attention away from the massive crimes being committed against the independent peoples of West Asia and the Middle East.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Tim Anderson joining us from Sydney. Also thanks to John Stepling speaking to us from Indore, Norway. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on. Welcome back. Palestinians have condemned Israel's move to prevent a call to prayer on the first day of Ramadan as a racist crime. Nabil Abu Radina, a spokesperson for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, called the move hostile and aggressive and warned of its consequences. He said such policies can turn the current conflict into an overt religious war. Abu Radina said the Israeli measure has been a blatant violation of human rights that can undermine the foundations of peace and security. On Tuesday, Israeli forces cut off the loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds to prevent the nighttime call to prayer. Palestinian authorities called on the Jordanian ambassador in Israel to express their strong protests against the Zionist regime's action. American protesters have taken to the streets in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, for the third straight night over the police killing of a black man. The demonstrators rallied despite a police ban on public gatherings. Chaotic scenes occurred when police used pepper spray and flash bombs to disperse the crowd, who responded with throwing bottles and projectiles. The third night of protests come despite the resignation of the police chief and the officer who fatally shot Dante Wright. He was killed after officers attempted to take him into custody for traffic violation on Sunday. The incident has once again sparked anger against police racism in the state of Minnesota, where police last year killed another black man, George Floyd. His death led to months of protests across the U.S. Coronavirus infections have hit a new peak in several Latin American countries as the number of cases and fatalities keeps rising worldwide. Argentina reported a record 27,000 cases in the past 24 hours. The government is now considering new emergency measures and restrictions. In Colombia, President Ivan Duque announced a lockdown in several cities in an attempt to halt the advance of a third wave of the disease. In Brazil, the world's third hardest hit country in terms of total cases, the Senate has launched a probe into President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the outbreak. He's drawn widespread criticism for his approach to the coronavirus, and Uruguay has gone from one of the least affected countries to registering the most new daily cases per capita in the world. India's new coronavirus infections hit another record, as the country registered more than 184,000 new daily cases. Total infections have reached 13.9 million. India's death toll has also increased by over 1,000 to an overall of nearly 173,000. Despite the surge, hundreds of thousands of Indians gathered on the Ganges riverside on Wednesday to mark a religious festival. This comes as India is battling a second wave of infections that has crippled its health system. Private hospitals are now turning patients away while public centers treat some patients in waiting queues. India's total infections rank after the U.S. as it overtook Brazil on Monday. Russia says it will continue dialogue over tensions with neighboring Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin made the remarks in a telephone call with his American counterpart Joe Biden. The White House said Biden urged Putin to de-escalate tensions with Kiev and voiced concern over Russia's military buildup in Crimea and on the Ukrainian border. Moscow says its troop deployments are in response to NATO's military activities that threaten Russia. The Kremlin says NATO's involvement in Ukraine has turned the country into a, quote, powder keg. Crimea rejoined Russia after a referendum in 2014, but Ukraine and its Western allies called the reunification an annexation. Since then, conflict has simmered between Kiev and Moscow, with a recent spike in violence in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbass. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel.
An Israeli court ruled that any Arabic language school or funding transport for Arab school children in the northern city of Carmiel is banned. The court says that anything otherwise would alter city's demographic balance and damage its character.
Until the years 2000, maybe even less, we had students who took the final exams in Arabic. No more ever since. Students lack the motivation. For them, the Arabic language, as I see that, is related to the Arab itself. We don't like the Arab, we don't need the Arab, and we don't want the Arab. So why do we need his language? It's totally equivalent, unfortunately.
In its decision, the court cited so-called nation-state basic law. This law was passed in 2018 and caused public uproar against it, inside Israel and outside Israel, for its apartheid nature. This move is not unprecedented, but shows Israel's racist policies on the indigenous people of the land. An Israeli court has ruled that the northern city of Carmiel is a Jewish city and that Arabic language schools or funding transport for Arab school children are liable to alter city's demographic balance and damage its character. Thus, it has blocked access to schools for Arab children in the northern city of Carmiel. The court implied that facilitating this access would incentivize Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel to move into the city, thus damaging its Jewish character. This is also true for funding the transportation of Palestinian Arab children living in the city to schools and surrounding communities. The ruling came after a lawsuit which charged that the city of Carmiel was violating its obligation to provide transportation for Arab Israeli children to local schools was dismissed out of hand. In the case, the plaintiffs sued the Carmiel municipality for 25,000 shekels, approximately $7,500, for transportation expenses for two Arab siblings, a brother and sister, who were forced to travel to a school in a nearby town because there are no Arabic language schools located in the city. For years, families and activists have demanded that the Carmel municipality fund school transportation for Israeli Arab children and has appealed to the Israeli Education Ministry to widen the map of neighboring communities associated with Carmel school transportation program, but obviously to no avail.
The judge ruled, actually, ruling is not surprising because the goal of establishing Jewish towns in the midst of Galilee is actually to Judaize the Galilee and prevent a majority of Arabs living there. So they don't want the Arabs to feel comfortable in the mixed towns. Okay, if they want to, you know, just go and live, pay, you know, property taxes and stuff, but they don't want them to establish, you know, Arabic symbols, like the language is one big symbol. So they refer to the national law, national bill, the new, that was put in state in 2018, which, you know, clearly states that the state of Israel is, you know, for the Jewish people, and they actually demoted the Arabic language from being an official language into a language with a special status. But that status was not defined really in a way so that anybody could come and refer to the national bill as they did in this ruling and base a ruling saying that, you know, Arabic is not, you know, a language and this is the Jewish state, and just, you know, use the basic law to, you know, to say no to any demand that has a flavor of nationality, such as the Arabic language. Like in Carmel, here in Nazareth Elite, or as recently changed, the city, his name was changed to Nof HaGalil, we have a long struggle here for many years to establish an Arabic school in the city of Nof HaGalil, where at least, you know, according to the Ministry of Education, there's about 40% of children in this city between the ages 5 and 19 that are Arab in the city, okay? And the population of the Arabs in this city is about 30%. So far, we only have kindergartens, and starting, you know, from first grade through the 12th grade, we have to go and find solutions outside the city. With a, you know, an ongoing refusal. So we have been in the court since 2013. The political struggle actually started way before, like at least 15 years before. We are actually awaiting the Supreme Court's ruling on our you know, case. The reason in my opinion, and you know, my many others who are in this struggle with me, that the municipality and actually the Ministry of Education refuse our request to establish an Arab school is actually to protect and preserve the Jewish, the Jewish status in the city, or the Jewish ethos. And so for them, we are only residents. We should not have any nationality rights. They don't want us to establish a community, because if you establish you know, a school, that means you establish a community. You know, my son will have you know, other kids in his age living in the neighborhood, and then there will be relations between me and the other, that child's parents, and then you will have actually you know, a living you know, community that grows and feels at home, more at home in the city, as opposed to just using it as, you know, like a hotel, because we all work outside, study outside, and then just come and sleep here. So there's no real community life here. So they don't want us to feel at home here. And, you know, recently they ran, you know, like people started demonstrating in front of the city, municipality, like first they ask for a school, and then they will ask for a mosque, you know, like presenting actually the fact that they don't want any symbol of Arab, you know, the Arab culture, whether it is Muslim or Christian or the language inside the city.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Raymond says Israel continues to steal Palestinian land on which to build illegal settlements in the opinion of almost every nation on earth. When Israel shows its disregard for human rights and ignoring international law, it gets criticized. Citizen Jane says Israel invokes nation-state law in denying transport to Palestinian school children in Galilee. Damascus Frey said Netanyahu literally said, according to the basic nationality law we passed, Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people, and only it.
People say that we should forget about 48 and we should just start a new chapter. But what happened in 48, namely the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, never stopped ever since 48. And therefore, we have to continue to remind ourselves that this ethnic cleansing and apartheid system is still around, and nothing changed ever since 48. And Carmel is just an example for what we all know. I mean, those who are sensitive enough for human rights know that being a Palestinian or an Israeli Arab in Israel means to be a second-class citizen. Being a Jew means to be a first-class citizen.
The court based its ruling on the so-called nation-state basic law. This law was passed in 2018 and caused public uproar against it, inside Israel and outside Israel, for its apartheid nature. On July 19, 2018, the Israeli Knesset voted 62-55 to approve the Jewish nation-state basic law that constitutionally enshrines Jewish supremacy and the identity of Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people. This law, which has distinct apartheid characteristics, guarantees the ethnic-religious character of Israel as exclusively Jewish and entrenches the privileges enjoyed by Jewish citizens, while simultaneously anchoring discrimination against the Israeli Arab minorities and legitimizing exclusion, racism, and systematic inequality. Carmiel was one of several cities and towns strategically established starting in the mid-1960s as part of an Israeli initiative to attempt to expand the Jewish presence in the Galilee, where Arabs made up most of the population. Carmiel is one of more than 700 communities the state has built for the Jewish population since Israel's founding, compared with none built for the Arab population. In March 1976, the Israeli military began confiscating and expanding several Jewish towns in the area. This was met by confrontations, including general strikes and street battles. This is known as Land Day and is commemorated every year in March.
These towns that were established in the Galilee, and starting in the 50s, 60s, and on, had a clear goal, which is to Judaize the Galilee, okay, which means establishing Jewish settlements there in the midst of the Arab towns to prevent Arabic continuous territory, okay? So the language of Arabic is, you know, part of, it's a national representation. It is it represents the language, it represents the culture. So for them, it contradicts the goal, which is to have a Jewish-only settlement. Another aspect of this struggle is the refusal to accept that we have been here forever, okay, and that that these towns like Nofa Galil, Karmiel, Afula were all established on confiscated Arab land. So like Palestinians living in Nazareth, in Kareni, in Ain Mahel, in Iksal, all these surrounding Arab towns, they had all, like, their lands were lost by the confiscation in order to establish the city, Nofa Galil. So where, like, the official language of the municipality is that we are coming here to attain a quality of life, because there's no quality of life in neighboring cities. Well, this is obviously a sarcastic, you know, way of looking at things, because the city of Nazareth, which has double the population of Nofa Galil, is sitting on only 14 square kilometers, whereas Nofa Galil, which is half, and all on confiscated land established in 1957, is still residing on at least 33 square kilometers. So it's very normal that people living in high density will want to, emigrate and move to a town which is, offering more places to live in.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. David says that Israel allocated 99.7% of public land in the occupied West Bank to Israeli settlers, illegal under international law. Only 0.24% went to the Palestinians. The nation-state law embedded apartheid. Have a look at it. The simple truth is that people had to be driven off their land. Noga says Netanyahu, the nation-state lawman who made Arabic not an official language and defined only Jewish communal rights in Israel, tells the Likud, "I believe in Jabotinsky's vision that every Israeli citizen should enjoy all rights. We appeal to Arab citizens, this time vote for us." Kieran says the nation-state law turns non-Jews in Israel into second-class citizens. In the occupied territories, Palestinians are under military law, while settlers are under Israeli civil law. Apartheid in action.
Well, this is what happens when you have the concept of a settler nation. A settler nation is a nation that basically invalidates the people of the land that they wish to settle. It's ethnic cleansing. The way that, you know, we can see is that whatever the Israelis have done, or the Zionists, really from the very earliest start, because, you know, my grandfather was a Zionist doctor who was kicked out of being the Zionist doctor of Palestine in Jerusalem in 1911 because he said, "Well, I'm a doctor, I take care of Arabs," and they said no, and they sent him away. And that's why he came to the United States. So the fact is that this is a country which has its basis in the deprivation of health, life, land to the people, and the interior was a beautiful place which had all kinds of gardens and parks, and it was beautiful before the Israelis took it over. But they did it as a cat's paw on the way, I think, to the northern part when they took, because it was established in 1964. In 1967 came the war where the Israelis captured Golan.
Although Arabs now constitute around 6% of Carmiel's population, that is around 2,760 people, there is still no Arabic language school inside the city. As such, Arab Israeli parents are forced to send their children to various schools in the area. According to the Education Ministry, it doesn't take part in school organization, just the funding and content of what's being learned. It says that the money goes to municipalities and that they use it for transportation and schools. The ministry says the funding is sufficient. However, the municipalities say the funding is not. Many of them are accused of pocketing the money. This dilemma has been faced by the Arab population for decades now. It seems that Israel wants to further isolate the Arabs. At least, that is how they feel. Through decades of neglect and now political isolation, the conditions might be just getting worse.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
The Gate of Knowledge. الجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184, or according to other counts 192 or 93 in Nahjul Balagha, which is known as the sermon of the pious people or the sermon of Hammam. And we were discussing this particular phrase from the sermon where Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the pious person is one who غائباً منكره حاضراً معروفه, that his evil is absent and his good is always present. So this is a very powerful state that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentioned. Of course, it needs a lot of effort, introductory work to be able to achieve, and everyone has different levels, so there may be people will still be in the process of having that character of always being good and always staying away from evil. But slowly and gradually, inshallah, what is required and what is expected from a human being is to be able to achieve that level. And then Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to explain and says مُقْبِلًا خَيْرُهُ مُدْبِرًا شَرُّهُ. Inshallah, we'll explain about this phrase today. But before we go on to that, I would like to first of all welcome all of you to this great banquet of the holy month of Ramadan, which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has invited all of us in this banquet to be able to benefit from the wonderful spiritual blessings that are hidden inside it. And may Allah make this month of Ramadan one full of piety and blessings for us.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that one of the qualities of the pious people is مُقْبِلًا خَيْرُهُ مُدْبِرًا شَرُّهُ, that a pious person is one whose good always comes forth. مُقْبِلًا خَيْرُهُ, as if, you know, like when you are there next to him, it's the good comes towards you. It's not that you go towards the good of the pious person. It's not like you go take, for example, sometimes I go to a stream and I collect the water from the stream with my hands. I go towards the stream and I collect that water and I drink it. Here, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, مُقْبِلًا خَيْرُهُ. It is as if the stream of goodness comes itself towards you, towards the people. مُقْبِلًا خَيْرُهُ. It comes as if it's inviting you, you see. أَقْبَلَ إِلَيْهِ means going towards. مُقْبِلًا خَيْرُهُ means his goodness is going towards people. That's how a pious person is. In different situations in his life, in the social arena, a pious person is careful. Let alone the wajibat, those rites that are necessary and wajib, that are obligatory for a pious person to perform. Those things are anyways there. But apart from that, even the other good actions that are mustahab, that are liked, you notice that a pious person has that. In all senses, you know, if it is about the facial expressions, even the smile, a pious person is such that whenever you come across him, one of the smallest examples of good would be that smile that he gives, and that expression of his in his face, where he is inviting and he is offering a gesture of peace, and then going towards also the greeting. So apart from smile, that also is a sadaqah according to the riwayat, according to the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Incidentally, people used to complain, and they would say that Imam Ali alayhi salam is a bit of a surprising leader because he's always smiling. Now, I'm surprised at them for saying that. In fact, if a leader is one that is always open and smiling, it invites people towards him and can therefore be effective in his tasks.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, apart from just the facial expressions and apart from the greeting with words, apart from the good words, also nasiha, giving words of advice and kindness where necessary. Not all the time. So there are some people who like, they are in advice mode and, you know, sermon mode full time. No, I'm not talking about that. When you see that your brother, when your friend is in trouble, when your friend is about to do something that is going to destroy him, with that nasiha comes from a pious person. So when a person like knows that he's in trouble or he wants to seek advice, he knows where to go. He goes to a pious person because he knows that good will come forward towards him when he'll go to that pious person. And of course, there are other forms of goodness apart from just the physical. There are other spiritual goodnesses that come from a pious person. The very fact that serenity that a pious person has, the prayer that a pious person does for the other people, is very, very effective. And another part that Imam Ali alayhi salam says now is mudbiran sharru. His evil has turned its back and is going away. Mudbiran sharru. So when a person comes across a pious person, he feels and he notices that there is no way that he can commit evil because that evil is actually going away from me. You know, it's turning away from me. It's, you know, going away. It's as if it's flying away from me, like a bird that is, that you know, that is near you, and then suddenly it lifts off and flies away. You know, mudbiran sharruhu is like that. When you come across a pious person, he's like that. And this is because of the high level of attention that a pious person has towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his duties. And therefore, the chances for evil to come out or to be expressed by such a person are very low. Now, this is the way also in the month of Ramadan when you are fasting. This is the state that you have. Because of the fact that you are controlling those desires within, it's giving you that aptitude to be always be a source of goodness and to be one whose evil is free and whose evil is not present. Rather, it's turning away its face and going away from people. Inshallah, let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us this opportunity in the month of Ramadan to be able to have these qualities. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
من ناداه أو لبّاه حين دعاه نلهنه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.